Welcome to FIC Focus, where Bloomberg Intelligence fixed income, credit currency, and commodities strategists and analysts discuss their short and long-term views on debt markets and issuers. Now, here's the Bloomberg Intelligence FIC research team.
Good morning. On this month's Masters of the Universe,
myself and co-host Karen Altamirano are happy to be joined by the Office of the New York State Comptroller, Thomas P. DiNapoli. This edition actually marks a slight departure from our previous slate of guests who have brought us perspectives on the market from the sell side and buy side and even data providers. But as the economy potentially heads toward a more volatile period, we thought it would be interesting to have the comptroller as a guest. And, you know, look, we have inflation proving to be anything but transitory right now. And hearing from one of the largest issuers in the market should be a topic of universal interest. Just some background real quick. DiNapoli has served as comptroller since 2007, winning re-election in 2010, 2014, and 2018. Pretty impressive. And while his office has many mandates, two areas for those in munis should be his oversight for spending of tax dollars and managing the state pension fund, one of the nation's better funded pools for those who are interested. So thank you for joining us, Comptroller. Very happy you're here again.
Eric, it is great to be with you, but you left out getting reelected in 2022.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, I'm going to have to update the bio. So shameful. Another reelection. The success in winning never ends with your office. Very
well,
good.
So far.
All right. So since the last time we chatted, a lot has changed with the economy. A lot has changed with the finances in New York State and New York City in particular. You know, the big thing for us is looking at inflation and how the Fed's going to react. Talk to us about where you see some of the larger challenges right now. And let's start at the state level and then sort of work our way down, you know, obviously into the metropolis.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, you used the word volatility earlier, and I think that's been the issue that certainly is with us in terms of revenue, certainly. And you mentioned our role in terms of investing in the state pension fund. The markets certainly have been volatile. You know, I would say from our perspective, the good news is it has been less volatile of late, right? That doesn't mean it might not pick up in volatility once again. Especially depending on what the Fed does or doesn't do and the timing on that. You know, I think the overall context is that the recession that everyone had been predicting for I don't know how many years now hasn't happened, probably is not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Of course, I could be wrong about that. You know, it could change 6 months from now. But at the very least, certainly, I think the economists that generally were talking about recession are now talking about, you know, a slowdown, but with a soft landing. So I think that is certainly a positive. You're right, inflation has been persistent, but it certainly has been coming down, perhaps not quite as low as we would like, but certainly compared to where we were a year ago, we see improvement there. In terms of the state's fiscal picture, the revenue projections were lowered over the past few months because the revenue was not coming in as high as anticipated. The state is very reliant on personal income tax, and that's certainly been an area of volatility. And we are still behind last year in terms of the absolute dollars, but because the projections were lowered, right now we're actually coming in ahead of the budget projections. So that's the context within which the state budget is being negotiated as we speak. The revenue picture did improve. The revenue forecast added another $1.35 billion over the next 2 years. So, you know, I would say overall for the state, city dynamic is a little different, but somewhat parallel. We are better than we thought we would be, not as strong as we'd like to be, but, you know, certainly compared to where we were projecting a year ago, yeah, we're in much better shape.
You know, has any of this, like, I don't want to say post-pandemic, right? Because it's really sort of a subjective term. But let's just say the period post-2021. Has any of sort of the recovery or financial changes since then been a surprise to you for the downside? Like, you're not where we thought we would be, even though we're slightly improved?
Well, you know, I think it would be fair to say we had a pretty rapid run-up when we started the recovery. It became sluggish, you know, and certainly for New York, yeah, you look at different indicators. You certainly look, you know, we mentioned tax revenue, but you look at the job recovery. We're now finally at about you know, some say we're at 100%, you know, some we would say probably a little bit shy of that, maybe 99% in terms of job recovery. It's taken New York longer than I think virtually every other state to get back to where we were pre-COVID. So I would say the elongated recovery phase probably was a bit surprising because we had, you know, we had kind of a fast run up out of the gate. I mean, I point to the, you know, the pension fund, you know, 3 years ago, I guess now, you know, we had a 33% positive return, you know, coming out of COVID. I mean, we never had a 33% return.
Are you taking any private money for that? I'm just asking for my own
guidance? No, no.
Yeah, okay, darn it. No, all right. No.
You know, I always say people should give me credit for brilliance, but some of it's, you know, timing and luck and obviously a good staff. But, you know, and then we were down the year after that to a plus 9%. So still, you know, way above our long-term assumed rate of return. And then last year we were at a minus 4. So, you know, so I don't know if you would call that volatility or you just started to see a slowing down of what had been a fast jump, you know, coming out of the gate. You know, and the same was true of revenue. Some of what drives where we're at right now as far as state finances also has been the impact of the federal money, which was significant. Correct. Really saved our state and local governments. That money is not all spent down, but virtually all spent down. So preparing for that reality, which I think we've done okay with, but a lot of folks, I think, assume that, you know, the good times are back. And sometimes I think the projections, you know, might be a little more optimistic than the reality, because I do think there are challenges with the economy. I think the political context that we're operating in is even more volatile than the markets. And there could be an upside, there could be a downside to that. But, you know, I would say overall, it's been the inability to be very precise in predicting where all this was going to go. Maybe that would be the downside, you know, that I would offer. It just seems in other years, there's been a bit more stable a picture where you could kind of anticipate the ups and the downs. I think now it's still a bit of a roller coaster. It's not like a high speed roller coaster, but it is kind of a roller coaster in looking at the markets, looking at the revenue. So it makes it really harder to figure out where we're going to be a couple of years from now.
You know, banking some of those years of, you know, really solid returns, have you guys changed the investment approach to the pension fund at all? You know, we've read or seen a lot of headlines about various other state pensions divesting from commercial real estate, taking less of a deeper dive into equities, just feeling the market feels kind of toppy. You know, what is your thought there?
Well, you know, I always say, you know, we're big, you know, we're you know, the third largest public pension fund in the country, you know, give or take $260 billion. So even when we want to make a move, you know, understood, you steer a big ship very slowly. Yes. So, you know, we have been updating, you know, there are always some tactical choices that are made, nothing dramatic. But I will say that as we're updating our asset allocation, we are putting more into the private markets, more into private equity, more into real estate. You know, frankly, some of that reflects the fact that the way valuations have been measured, you know, the public side just was lower and the private side went up just because of valuations. The other change that happened in New York, which gives us more flexibility in terms of private markets, is that, as you probably know, you know, we have a legal list in terms of what we call the basket. We can't have, you know, roughly keeping it simple, more than 25% of our assets in the private markets, so the alternatives. The legislature changed that, allowed now up to 35%. I don't anticipate we're going to be anywhere near 35%, but we are able to add a bit more on the private market side. And, you know, so far, I have to say that, you know, private equity and real estate has been performing well for us. Okay. Some of the more creative things we've been able to do actually has been in some of the private space. So as always, the public markets, the public equity markets are still the biggest part of the portfolio. But yeah, it is a slightly reduced percentage now.
You know, you mentioned earlier about revenues coming in, you know, softer, but still, you know, above where projections are. Where are we with the expenses? You know, are we able to, you know, maintain some of the expenses? Yeah. With inflation being as high as it is, you know, I imagine expenses are significantly higher this year.
Yeah, I don't know that I would say significantly. I think they had, you know, when you look at the executive budget proposal, it was a much more modest increase than we've seen in recent years. And I think that reflects the governor's concern as number one, where the economy is headed, number two, the federal money being spent down. So, you know, I guess overall it was about a 4% when you look at the numbers. So, you know, certainly in line with inflationary numbers. But that's what the legislature is debating now, right? Because you know, you take an area like school aid, which has seen significant increases over the years. Governor proposed an increase, but it was a much more modest increase than we've seen. Medicaid is another sticking point always, healthcare spending. And the governor included a proposal to try to save about $1.1 billion in Medicaid spending. That's been a very fast-growing part of the budget as well. Yeah. But, you know, I suspect as the legislature negotiates that you'll probably see, you know, increases to what the governor proposed. What the governor has also said, though, is that we have to align the spending and the revenue and do it without raising taxes. And as you know, the legislature has proposed some additional taxes, both on the corporate side and another surcharge for wealthier New Yorkers. We'll see how that finally gets worked out in the final budget. But I think the governor made pretty clear that with the concern that she has and many of us have, we've done reports on taxpayer migration. You know, we're not, when people ask me about that, I say, you know, not everybody's leaving like the critics say, but are we losing? Is there a net decrease in the number of folks at the higher end? You know, the top 1%, you know, carry about 1.5%, carry about 40% of the personal income tax revenue. So when you lose too many at that end, it does have an impact. The other side of it, though, which is accurate, we're actually losing probably more people at the lower end because of the affordability issue in our state. But I think the governor was concerned about taxpayer migration. And so I think she's been pretty clear that tax increases should not be the remedy. We should balance expenses and spending. My concern as controller always is, you know, when you're debating over raising taxes, which isn't always popular, or cutting programs to balance the budget, which also tends not to be popular, especially in election year, what often happens is more money is borrowed. And that's not good because, you know, we are still a very highly indebted state. So I'm hoping that however this is all resolved, you know, cooler heads will prevail. And, you know, a budget is always a compromise. But I think what the governor put forward was a good place to start.
I want to ask you a question about, you had mentioned earlier about the school aid and the changes that the governor made to the foundation aid formula going from I think a 4% increase that we saw last year, the past 2 years down to 2.4% this year, but it's still an increase nonetheless. Yeah. But I know a lot of people are worried about how that's going to impact school districts. So I want to get your thoughts on how do you feel school districts will be able to, you know, do they have the reserves in place to be able to weather these types of changes to the school aid formula?
That's a good question. So let me approach that a couple of ways. So I think one of the challenges with, because the overall numbers sound reasonable, right? I think part of the issue that's being raised with the governor's proposal is that she recalculated the way the foundation formula would be implemented, including eliminating what's been called save harmless or hold harmless, which has been part of the school aid formula forever. When I was in the legislature, that was always kind of a sacrosanct point. So when you actually saw the distribution, you actually saw a number of school districts getting less money, although the overall pie was growing. And I think that's why you're seeing a lot of pushback. Now, the argument the other way is that enrollment has been declining, so shouldn't, you know, the costs be declining? Well, you know, there are many fixed costs and there's been an issue about, you know, recruitment and retention. So salaries have certainly gone up, particularly coming out of COVID. You know, the issues of reserves is an interesting one. We do audits of school districts across the state, and we have cited many school districts as having excess reserves, meaning that in terms of fund balance that they transfer from year to year, they exceed the statutory limit, which is 4%. Or they have other kinds of reserves that they've set up that are, again, way funded beyond, you know, what they could reasonably expect to use the money for. And we often get criticized by the district that we're auditing when we say that, because they say, well, we can't depend on the state. We don't know what the state aid will be. But, you know, our position has always been the statute says 4%. You should not exceed that fund balance. And particularly when we see many cases where districts are raising taxes at the same time, they have these large reserves. Yep. So, you know, some of what the governor may be trying to do is really, you know, force the districts to be a bit more appropriate in terms of how they're managing their fund balance and their reserves. Keep in mind, when we do those audits and when we cite a district for having excessive reserves or excessive fund balance, we have no enforcement authority, right? So although the statute says you can't have beyond X amount, there's no enforcement mechanism other than, you know, shame at a district budget meeting, which sometimes has minimal effect, sometimes it has an effect. But I think part of what the governor, part of what the governor's argument, I think, is that many of the districts could actually weather this because they have been squirreling away excessive reserves. But
So one of the things we've seen, not just in New York, but other states, is a palpable uptick in news headlines about budget cuts, personnel cuts on school district level, because they spent the COVID money that came in on full-time employees, right? And then a couple of years go by and they're like, oh no, there's no money anymore to fund these positions. Are you finding that to be the case with a lot of the New York local districts as well?
I think I would say, based on what I've seen, less so with some of the local districts. It's certainly been an issue with New York City. You know, certainly in terms of 3K, and of course the city has the added issue, not related to the federal funding, but the class size mandate. Yeah. And what we've indicated, and we've been warning of this for a while, is that there was a cliff, particularly with education funding, DOE funding, as the federal money would be spent down. And that's still one of the risks we see in the out years with the city's budget. That the education expense, which is a big part of the budget, obviously, that they haven't identified where they're going to come up with the money to implement the programs. I've seen that more as a dynamic with the city education budget than I have with some of the budgets outside of the city.
Okay. Quick pivot, and I just want to go back to the migration issue. Obviously, it's something that is continually written about from our news side, and something that we definitely note on the strategy side. But just by the numbers, I think New York has lost about $6 billion in tax receipts this year to out-migration, right? And it sounds like a really big number. But I mean, in reality, you're talking about a small piece of a very large pie. I mean, how concerned are you with out-migration? I mean, do you see it as sort of a, an age-related issue that's going to sort of work its way through the system, or almost like a tax referendum issue where folks are just picking up and leaving in protest, in a sense?
Well, let me say a couple of things. First, I think it's an issue we should be concerned about. First of all, migration population doesn't help us because politically we've seen a shrinking of our congressional representation because of that. So that's the population piece. In terms of the tax piece, you know, as I said earlier, the higher income folks carry a bigger share of the personal income tax revenue. So you don't want to lose them. They're the ones that we tax, right? We just put out our Wall Street bonus report. And I always say we want the folks on Wall Street to be making yes. money and be profitable because we're going to tax them. So from a government revenue perspective, I think we all need to be concerned about that. I think where it becomes harder to analyze that is that I don't think it's fair to say it's only because of tax burden. I do think quality of life issues, particularly for people who may be leaving New York City, you know, because don't forget, you know, when we talk about the out-migration out of the state, there's also movement within the state. You know, so you have a lot of folks during COVID that decamped outside of New York City to Long Island, Hudson Valley. They may have already had a second home. They yep. now change their address. So we don't lose them from state tax revenue. The city loses them, you know, from the city income tax. But I think quality of life, meaning personal safety and personal security, issue of homelessness, cleanliness in the city, safety on the subways, mental health issues in terms of folks who are wandering the streets and doing some unpleasant things. That's harder to quantify, but I certainly, when I hear anecdotally, yeah, you hear about tax burden, but you also hear about quality of life for folks in the city. So I do think that as the city administration grapples with all those issues, and you know, the governor has tried to be helpful in terms of a greater presence in the subways as far as law enforcement, and certainly a significant increase in the funding for mental health services, which really we've underinvested in for a long time, including for inpatient beds. We actually have a report coming out on this in a couple of days. So I do think there's an attempt to deal with those quality of life issues. I think that impacts on the migration as well.
I mean, you mentioned, you know, sort of trying to take a balanced approach to the budget. But I mean, at the end of the day, right, are you more in favor of further tax increases to help sort of mitigate that outflow? I mean, if you have a disproportionate amount of higher earners leaving, there's only so much you can cut, right, before you sort of, you know, really, you know, stick it to the people who are left behind.
Well, you know, I think that's where, and there's no science on this. You know, my concern is that when do you reach the tipping point that you really cause an out-migration to become, you know, a stampede? And you know, so we already have a surcharge on higher income New Yorkers. The city has obviously an income tax as well. When you aggregate for city residents, it's a higher burden than even California, you know, at this point. So I am concerned about that. What I also think we don't do an adequate job of in New York, because you're right, you know, it's often the equation is, you know, cutting programs to balance the budget, raising taxes, or as I said, the third alternative, borrowing. There's actually a fourth way with all this that we don't spend enough time on, and that's spending our money more wisely, more smartly. Just take the Medicaid program, which is a huge expense area. We are continually doing audits of Medicaid spending, finding opportunities to realize efficiency, save money, because of inefficiencies in the program and duplicate payments and a whole raft of issues with Medicaid spending, that you could save money and not hurt the services that people depend on.
Yeah.
So, you know, we really should do a better job, I would say, of reading the controller audits as far as state spending, but just more broadly, you know, just being a little smarter, because we, you know, there still is more or less the attitude, well, this is what we spent last year, so how much are we going to increase it by? There isn't enough. It's almost like that old concept of zero-based budgeting that isn't talked about much anymore. But, you know, there is another way on some of this. But we get so locked into short-term thinking, short-term budgeting. You know, that's one of the things I see different being controller rather than being a legislator. When you're a legislator, you're focused on this session, this budget coming up. What am I going to go home and tell everybody I got more money for? Sure. Not on long-term budget balance. If we spend a little more time on that, we could perhaps have a more effective way of spending taxpayer money.
I agree.
I want to get your thoughts on, you know, how we're funding the asylum seeker crisis. You know, there's a proposal that $2.4 billion state aid is being allocated over 2 years to provide services for asylum seekers, with $500 million of that coming from state reserves. What is your view on tapping into the state reserves for that?
Yeah. Well, I think. You know, just broadly, you know, we've been saying for a long time that we have inadequate reserves. And I give Governor Hochul and the legislature credit for building them up. You know, so we have more than we've had in many, many years. So that's good. I think, you know, we need to maintain the reserves. I would actually add to them a bit. I think to, you know, a short-term use of $500 million, I don't have a big issue with that. I would like to see the money added back on top of the $19.5 billion, you know, once hopefully the migrant expense goes down. But I do take issue with those that say, well, we've got all these reserves, we have all these other needs, you know, we don't need that much in reserves. Well, we do, you know, we actually need a bit more than that from my perspective. So I would say, you know, long term, obviously on the migrant issue generally, we do need help from Washington. It doesn't seem to be forthcoming. And the state can't pick up, you know, particularly for the city, pick up the entire burden. The governor's trying to help. But the reserve should be set up for a true economic emergency, meaning what happened after the Great Recession hit and the markets collapsed and revenue collapsed. What happened during COVID-19 when we had a shutdown, people weren't working, people laid off, and revenues are way down. Those are the kind of emergencies where you should be tapping into reserves. So, you know, the fact that we're in a strong position and we had made enough to use a little bit amount of it for the migrants, okay, we should put that money back in at some point, and we should take, you know, the bulk of the reserves are really informal reserves. They're not in the statutorily established reserves where there is a restriction on using them, where you would, in some cases, need legislative action to spend the money. So I would prefer to see the reserves as much as possible put into restricted reserve accounts, not kind of this float of, you know, money for economic uncertainties, because it could be used for just about anything. And depending on who the governor is and who the, you know, who the legislature is, you could see that money quickly depleted.
Is there a certain number in your mind or percentage amount that would be an adequate cushion?
Well, you know, I kind of think that where we're at now is adequate, but I'd like to see us better than adequate. So I don't necessarily have a hard and fast number for you. Yeah. I've just been pleased that they have ratcheted up as much as they have, but we're still as a percentage behind, you know, some other states. So I think there's more work we could do there.
And look, I know we're running short on time. We appreciate you, you know, giving us the time you did have today. I want to finish with one last question about, you know, some topics that are of special interest to us, right? Working from home, that persistent sort of, you know, hybrid work, and, you know, how that's impacting and informing the commercial real estate market, the challenges in the city and the state. You know, just wanted to get your thoughts on that. You know, are you surprised at all that this is still an issue, you know, coming on 4 years later?
I don't know if I'm surprised. I think it's just the reality. You know, we have it with our own agency, right? You have a lot of workers that got used to remote work. Some of our unions are pressing for even a higher percentage of remote than we have right now. Trying to attract younger employees very often, again, it's anecdotal, but very often from what I hear, the first question they ask is, can I work 100% remote? So there is certainly a changed attitude about, and my answer is no, by the way,
yeah.
but of course I'm of a different generation, but there's no doubt that the workplace has changed. And I think the hybrid model is with us for a long period of time. Look, the Class A office buildings in the city are doing just fine and they'll continue to do fine. It's, you know, it's the lower end, lower class buildings that for various reasons, people are vacating or not renewing leases. Part of it is not so much of a need for people to be in the workplace. So I do worry ultimately what will that do to the assessed valuation, particularly for the city. Obviously, the Central Business District in Manhattan, the impact of not having the office workers in terms of the restaurants and retail and, you know, just spending time in New York during the day and at night is having a continuing impact. So, you know, it certainly is a concern. Is one of the remedies perhaps converting some of these buildings, office buildings, into residential? Might be. I'm not sure that there's going to be a whole lot of that. I think that's a lot easier said than done. But I think for now, that is still a big challenge. And, you know, anything that could be done to get more people back in the city, I think would be good. And I know, you know, for me personally, I just think having people in the office, look, especially when you're trying to onboard new people, it's very hard to onboard people when they're working from their home. How do they understand the organization, the culture? How do you develop relationships, mentors, you know? I think it's a challenge, but it's not one that's going away. So am I surprised? No, maybe I'm more disappointed than surprised, but I think it is a reality. You know, we have to figure out how to work around.
Nice. Well, look, we appreciate your time and we thank you very much for joining us. And hopefully we can talk after your next reelection.
I hope before then. That's not for 2 years, 2.5 years. So
all right, that's a date then.
We'll make a date.
All right. Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.